This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Friday, March 28, 2008. Sitting in for Aldo Bogado in Los Angeles, I'm Tandasizwe Shimaringa. The Earth Liberation Front is accused of arson in Washington State. And a federal court snubs the latest attempt at justice for imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll have those stories and more in today's newscast, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. The head of the Environmental Protection Agency has come under criticism for his move to delay the agency's response to an order from the Supreme Court. EPA Chief Stephen Johnson has opted to open a lengthy public comment period on the risk of greenhouse gases, rather than to implement immediate policy changes based on recommendations from the agency's own scientists. The Supreme Court last spring ruled that the EPA must evaluate the risk CO2 emissions posed to the public and to the environment. Agency scientists concluded CO2 does constitute a serious threat and recommended new rules to reduce emissions. The lengthy public comment period virtually ensures that the federal government will take no significant action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions for the duration of the Bush administration. In other news, Baghdad is under a three-day curfew as clashes between Iraqi forces and militias continue in Basra and elsewhere in southern Iraq. Hiba Dawood has more.
The Iraqi government today ordered a three-day curfew in Baghdad, fearing that the clashes in Basra and other cities could escalate and spread to the capital. The Iraqi army and police forces have been battling Shiite militias in Basra since Tuesday morning and have been facing major challenges in their attempt to eliminate the armed groups. The Basra militias are well armed as a result of years of infiltration within the ranks of the Iraqi security forces. The U.S. military at first acted in an advisory capacity to the Iraqi forces but has since taken a more active role by launching airstrikes over Basra last night. Hassan Jum'a is a resident of Basra.
The situation for people here is miserable. For the fourth day, there is a curfew. People don't have enough food and water because they weren't given forewarning of such a security operation. The security situation is not stable, and people expect to be attacked while inside their homes at any moment.
The overall death toll since the offensive began is unclear, but is believed to be over 130. This is Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
Negotiations for the release of hostages held by Colombia's FARC guerrillas could possibly resume in light of a government offer to release imprisoned rebels in exchange for former presidential candidate Ingrid Betancourt and other hostages. Manuel Rueda has more from Bogota.
The government has not yet said how many guerrillas it's willing to liberate, but President Álvaro Uribe signed a decree last night that would enable the Colombian courts to pardon the sentences of up to 500 guerrillas. Government supporters have called it a bold move, but not everyone is sure that the rebels will accept the deal. Camilo Gómez is a former National Peace Commissioner.
The important thing for them is not the release of the imprisoned guerrillas. What they demand and have been seeking is to sit down with the government because it's a sign of political recognition for them.
The government's offer does not include a military withdrawal from two municipalities that are crucial to the FARC's objectives, a key demand in past negotiation attempts. Uribe's decree follows recent news about Betancourt's critical health condition. Yesterday, Colombia's state attorney revealed that in February, the guerrillas took her to a health post in a remote area. She's allegedly suffering from hepatitis B, malnourished, depressed, and unwilling to live. This morning, Colombia's main radio networks lined up politicians, friends, and family of Betancourt to call on the rebels to release her to save her life. The government is now awaiting the rebels' response. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogota.
The Cuban government today lifted restrictions on the ownership of cell phones. Permission for cell phone ownership in Cuba has previously been limited to foreigners, staffers for international companies, and government officials. The new cell phone service for the general public has been regarded as a sign of openness from the new Cuban president, Raúl Castro, although cell phone service will be out of price range for most Cubans. And finally, five North Carolina truck plant workers who were fired last year for leading a strike are now fighting their union for their jobs and taking their message on the road. Ari Paul has more from New York.
The leaders of UAW Local 3520's bargaining committee, representing workers at the Freightliner Company, led a walkout over stalled contract negotiations. Known as the Freightliner Five, the workers have traveled to Los Angeles and the company's hometown of Portland to spread their message. Two of the workers, Robert Whiteside and Alan Bradley, will bring the speaking tour to New York City tomorrow. Bradley says the United Automobile Workers International won't come to their aid because the strike they led was not sanctioned at the international level. But he argues that their termination has effectively crippled the local union, making it too friendly with management and too fearful to file grievances. One of the organizers of the New York speaking event says that the case of the Freightliner Five highlights the difficulties of labor organizing in southern states, many of which have so-called right-to-work laws. Only 3% of North Carolina's workers are unionized, says Bradley. The workers hope to encourage labor supporters to reach out to the UAW and ask it to try to get the Freightliner Five's jobs in order to strengthen their local. In New York, I'm Ari Paul for FSRN.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
A three-judge panel of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia has rejected Mumia Abu-Jamal's latest appeal for a new trial. Abu-Jamal's current legal status leaves him with the option of being resentenced to death or sentenced to life in prison. FSRN spoke with Ramona Africa in Philadelphia regarding this latest development.
My understanding is that the Third Circuit Court of Appeals recently denied Mumia's petition for a new trial.
Right.
And there were like four areas that the defense team had argued were grounds for a new trial. And right now the option is only one of, I guess they denied the new request for a new jury trial and they're asking for a new sentencing. Is that correct?
Right. They denied the petition for a new trial and just granted a new sentencing hearing.
So now, what does that mean for Mumia?
Absolutely something that's not good. The only options in a resentencing hearing is to reinstate the death penalty or to give him life in prison, mm-hmm. which is not acceptable. I mean, that's what the district court was offering before. And Mumia would not accept it because he's innocent. I mean, you know, it's like giving him a choice between an execution or a long, slow, drawn-out death, you know. And Mumia is innocent, so he wouldn't accept that. And that's why he appealed to the Third Circuit. I mean, yeah, to the Third Circuit Court of Appeal. And now they're just basically doing the same thing. And, you know, it is absolutely outrageous. Because there is so much evidence, so many things even that have come to light since 1981 when he was convicted and sentenced, you know. So many things have come to light. You have a person that came forward and actually confessed to the crime, but have yet to be able to get into court to testify and tell his story because the courts just arbitrarily dismiss it as uncredible, you know. But how do you know that if you don't hear the testimony, you know? You have a common pleas court judge who presided over Mumia's post-conviction appeal and said that, oh, yeah, you know, there's a confession at issue here, but it's not credible. And plus, well, you know, it was filed too late according to the statute, so that's out. And we're saying, what in the world does time have to do with the truth when a man's life is at stake here?
So it's looking like most of the denials that Mumia is getting are coming from procedural things.
Yeah, it's coming from procedural basis, but the thing that people really need to understand is how outrageous it is because I don't know what the time is for filing, you know, when new evidence comes forward. But the point is that people should not get past is that if somebody is coming forward and you got new evidence and a man's life is at stake, how in the world can you just dismiss that and say, oh, well, you know, the statute says it should be filed in this amount of time and, you know, you were a little late filing it, so we're not even going to deal with it. Mm-hmm. When a man's life is at stake, I mean, how dare these people?
What is the timeline that we are actually looking at now? What is the timeline in terms of what is going to happen to Mumia now?
Well, what's going to happen next is, I guess, barring an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Common Pleas Court will then set a date for resentencing. And, you know, we don't know when that will be. I mean, it took them almost a year for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit to make their ruling. So we don't know when the Common Pleas Court will schedule the resentencing hearing. And once they do that and resentence Mumia, you know, it will depend on what they resentence him to. If they reinstate the death penalty, then they will set a date. If they resentence him to life in prison, well, you know, there won't be an execution date. Mumia will be looking at spending the rest of his life in prison.
Ramona Africa, thank you so much for your time. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can listen to today's newscast online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. A group of Polish activists, including the Campaign Against Militarism and Poles for a Referendum, has prepared for a mobilization against the installation of missiles and the building of the U.S. base in Poland. The action, scheduled for March 29th, is part of a larger anti-militarist struggle, which is taking place throughout Europe, including campaigns in Słupsk, northwestern Poland, where elements of the shield are to be placed. Their protest coincides with reports in Polish papers that the country is to speed up negotiations on hosting elements of the American anti-missile shield on its soil. Danuta Eisler reports from Warsaw.
Last May, Poland's government confirmed that the military airbase of Rędzikowo near Słupsk and 447 kilometers from Warsaw had been designated to house the anti-missile system. Though most opinion polls show that Poles are generally against the idea, some locals see economic advantages coming their way. Sławomir Ziemianowicz, Słupsk's mayor, is convinced that the deal, which is still being negotiated, does not constitute a threat to local inhabitants.
The base does not cause any harmful emissions or have any other negative influence on the surrounding environment. Its surface will fluctuate from 200 to 600 hectares. It will give employment to 200 to 300 people and will be open 24 hours all the year round. It contains its own integral power supply. The base will also be able to utilize the network of external infrastructure.
According to Polish anti-war activists, much of the negotiations are done in secret, despite demands by citizens and some political parties to hold a public referendum on the issue of U.S. bases. They also claim that the system is sold to the public without providing reliable information. Damien Moran, an Irishman currently living in Warsaw, represents Tarcza.org or TheShield.org, an organization which has called for March 29th to be a national day of protest against militarism in Poland.
The primary aim is to attempt to make sure that there is a public debate about this issue, because the mainstream media have largely been either just publishing what the government has been saying or what American lobbyists have been saying. And there has been little or no public debate. Ordinary members of the city of Słupsk and people in Rzeczykowo or throughout Poland have not had their voices listened to in terms of demanding for a referendum.
Tomorrow's events will include a public discussion at the Słupsk town hall, where members of the public will be able to present their concerns. There will be street theater and a symbolic planting of trees in Rzeczykowo as an example of putting this former military base to, quote, human use. Participants will also be able to meet international activists. One of them is Kieran O'Reilly from Australia.
We're here to say that the weapons involved are indiscriminate. They kill men, women and children. They're immoral and they're illegal. An incredible waste of money. Hopefully it'll be the beginning of more nonviolent resistance to the space.
Approximately 60% of Słupsk region inhabitants are against the possible deployment of anti-missile shield elements in the former military base of Rzeczykowo, according to a poll commissioned by the Center for Civic Initiatives in Słupsk. One of them is Jerzy Wołoszyn, a local entrepreneur who has already collected several hundred signatures in protest of the move.
There are only American interests represented here. It's not only the potential question of terrorists. It is mainly about limitations to our sovereignty. Also, I don't want to keep quiet on this issue because I'm a local inhabitant who cares about the development of this region. I want it to be independent, and I don't want to see any external pressures.
Tomorrow's events coincide with reports that Poland is to speed up negotiations on hosting elements of the American anti-missile shield on its soil. The Polish government has not said when it would give its consent to the project, but according to unofficial information from the government sources, it could come before summer holidays. I'm Danuta Isler, Free Speech Radio News, Warsaw.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can listen to today's newscast online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Since the early 1990s, the ELF has claimed responsibility for dozens of instances of politically inspired property damage, including the 1998 Vail firebombing that was considered the costliest act of eco-terrorism in the country, causing $12 million in damage. On Monday, March 3rd, in Woodinville, Washington, arsonists set fire to three uninhabited but furnished luxury model homes, causing an estimated $7 million of damage. A spray-painted banner at the scene mocked builders' claims that the mansions were environmentally friendly and bore the letters ELF, the initials of the Earth Liberation Front, a decentralized collective of radical environmentalists. Aaron Siegel reports.
Ecoterrorism is defined by the FBI as the use or threatened use of violence of a criminal nature against innocent victims or property by an environmentally oriented subnational group for environmental political reasons or aimed at an audience beyond the target, often of a symbolic nature. Martin R. Stoller is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
It's used as a terror tactic, actually, by the government. It's used to criminalize dissent and to put it in its worst light. After September 11th, we have had that terrorism attached to every type of thing we can imagine. We've got narco-terrorism, we've got eco-terrorism, we've got terrorism. We've got definitions of terrorism in the U.S. Patriot Act, which basically criminalized dissent and could be used for people who protest government policies. And it's really a scare tactic by the executive branch and the law enforcement branch to quell any kinds of dissent.
Since 2000, the U.S. government has prosecuted over 20 cases involving environmentalists. Notable cases of property damage deemed terror include the case of Jeff Lors, an environmental activist from Los Angeles who was initially sentenced to serve over 22 years for torching empty SUVs in a dealer's parking lot. Priya, also known as Warcry, is a friend and supporter of Jeff Lors.
Eco-terrorism is a term we hear in the media, on the corporate media, and it's a term that actually originated in timber industry PR firms, and that's public relations firms, and then it was picked up by law enforcement, then it was uncritically, of course, appropriated by the corporate media, and this dangerously ends up biasing political thought and criminal procedure, and it ends up criminalizing dissent.
The FBI is investigating the fires in Woodinville as a potential act of domestic terrorism. Bureau spokesperson Robbie Burrows explains the implications the label will have on the case.
The first is that the FBI becomes the lead investigative agency. We're working with the ATF and with local authorities. But also, even if this was an isolated incident, it would certainly be considered an appalling crime, but designating it eco-terror incident elevates it to a higher priority for us due to the scope of the problem of eco-terrorists and the links to several other incidents. So that allows us to devote more resources to the investigation, including our JTTF, the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
In 2005, federal authorities charged over a dozen people involved in ELF activities around Olympia, Washington, and Eugene, Oregon. The group claimed responsibility for about 17 fires between 1996 and 2001, most notoriously the 1998 firebombing of Colorado's Vail Ski Resort. Codenamed Operation Backfire, the sting operation involved multiple agencies and investigations, as well as planted undercover agents who infiltrated the ELF. The criminal investigation culminated in the December 7, 2005 arrest of seven people, including New Yorker Daniel McGowan. I spoke with Sean, a friend of McGowan and organizer with the group Family and Friends of Daniel McGowan, about the impact Operation Backfire has had on the environmental movement.
I think it's very stifling. This country has a very proud history of direct action, and we have a lot of issues from war to continuing ecological destruction that are not being addressed by legislators and not being addressed properly through popular means, whether that be through petition or through protest. And I think when people see people being threatened like Daniel was with life plus 335 years for having participated in two actions that resulted in no injury and no loss of life, I think it's stifling for people to kind of think exactly how we can change things and make this place a better world to live.
As of today, weeks after the Washington State arsons, the FBI has not named any suspects. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Aaron Siegel from New York, New York.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can listen to today's newscast online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. An estimated 6.2 million children in Afghanistan began school this month, up by 500,000 from the year before. But the United Nations Children's Fund estimates that still, in the seventh year of the NATO occupation, only about a third of Afghan boys complete primary schools, compared to 13% of girls. UNICEF is appealing for nearly $13 million in emergency funding for Afghanistan. Zach Badorf reports from Kabul.
UNICEF says hundreds of thousands of Afghan children lack proper food, water, and other essentials as continuing conflict hampers the delivery of help. One child out of four does not live to five. Sikandar Khan, the deputy country representative for UNICEF in Afghanistan.
Children in this country basically need everything from water, clean, safe drinking water, to access to quality education. And anything between that, including protection, whether it's physical, whether it's legal, whether it's social. So all those elements are the need for children in this country.
The UN says 2 million primary school-aged children, about 60% of all children, are out of school. About 1.3 million of these are girls. The UN says there's a shortage of qualified teachers and frequent attacks on schools by the Taliban. The Afghan Ministry of Education reports nearly 4,000 schools do not have buildings. And on the streets of Kabul alone, at least 70,000 children are working to support their families. They shine shoes, wash cars, sell small items, collect metal. Others just beg, anything to bring in income for their families. 11-year-old Shabana sells chewing gum each day for 10 rupees, or about 20 cents each. She usually doesn't make more than 40 rupees a day. She uses the money to help her family of eight.
I have two other brothers also selling chewing gum. We have to do it. There's no other way. It's really difficult.
Class in session at Afghanistan Children, A New Approach, or ASHIANA. It's a support organization for working children like Shabana. After meeting social workers, Shabana's parents agreed to let their daughter spend the mornings studying here.
I'm really happy. They ask us good questions and we respond eagerly. We learn a lot of things and I'm really happy here. I would be illiterate and working on the streets without ASHIANA.
ASHIANA street children play traditional Afghan songs on an accordion and drums. Music classes are just one of many recreational and vocational skills they learn at ASHIANA, which means nest in Dari. Here they teach calligraphy, woodwork, painting, even metalwork, skills they can use when they start working. Thirteen-year-old Hamid Hassan carves intricate wood designs inside a workshop at ASHIANA. In the afternoons, he collects aluminum soda bottle cans on the streets to sell to a metal shop. With no father, he worked full-time to support his mother and brother from the age of 7 to 11.
I was really upset watching other students going to school. I wondered, why can't I go to school? The reason was my parents couldn't afford the pens or notebooks.
Zahir Gauss, the Afghanistan Deputy Minister of Youth.
The families don't have money to spend on children to go to school. They are very, very poor people, and they can't get opportunities to pay for the books for their children to send them to school.
But Gauss said the country is very lucky because 6 years ago, the children of Afghanistan were in a terrible condition.
They couldn't do anything for their future. Now we are hopeful about their future.
The UN Sikandar Khan agrees life has improved for children since the fall of the Taliban.
There's no question about that. But the question is whether those improvements are sufficient for anyone to slow down. And I don't think so. I think there's been huge improvements. There's been good investments and targeted investments that have been made. The challenges before us are huge, are humongous. And I would appeal to everyone around the world not to forget, not to lose that momentum.
The Afghan government has set a goal to enroll an extra 330,000 girls in school this year. UNICEF, meanwhile, is supporting the construction of about 300 schools in 2008 while training some 48,000 teachers and developing textbooks and syllabi. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Kabul.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Today's program was produced by Monica Lopez and Tena Yusei. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team is Antonio Ortiz and Rose Kitachi. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Tandisizwe Shimaringa.